This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Here's to you, 2022. We are continuing our series looking at the year ahead, and today we start with politics. Big election year in Massachusetts. Legislative races, governor's race, also re-election bids in all nine of the state's U.S. House seats. Now listen, we know you are probably not ready to think about an election that is 10 months away. We get that. But we are, and we want to let you know what we'll be watching for you and what issues could emerge this year to be pretty important to you. So what is lurking in the background this year in the world of politics that could matter for you? We ask you to join the conversation, and here's how we'll ask it of you. What is the biggest political question for Massachusetts in 2022? Tell us what you think. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or tweet us. We are at Radio Boston. Two guests joining us now. Lisa Kaczynski is a Politico reporter, author of the Massachusetts Playbook, and Gary Daffin, executive director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition and the co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Gary, welcome back to you too.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to ask you guys the same question. Lisa, I'll start with you. What do you think is the single biggest political question in the Commonwealth for this coming year?
Well, at the moment, it's whether Maura Healey's running for governor or not. But I think in general, you know, it's a wide open governor's race. I mean, this is going to be the story for this year. And then apparently the lieutenant governor's race right along with it, because the field seems to be growing by the day for that one.
So why is that such a big question, Lisa?
Well, open seats are rare, especially for the highest office in the state, and especially for the fact that Democrats, even in this blue state, haven't always held the governor's office. You know, we've had a lot of Republican governors, particularly over the past three decades or so, you know, Deval Patrick being really the only break in that. And this is the clearest shot that they have had in this whole stretch, you know, since Deval Patrick and going back, you know, through Bill Weld and the others to reclaim this office. And the question is Maura Healey going to get in? Signs are certainly looking like it. Of course, we said that about Governor Charlie Baker until he decided not to seek a third term. But this is a big moment for Democrats, both the governor's office and down the ballot, just trying to kind of push the progressive envelope across the state and kind of seeing how far they can go with it.
Gary Daffin, do you agree? Is Maura Healey's decision on the governor's race the biggest question for politics in Massachusetts this year, or at least for now?
I do. I think a corollary is, will Massachusetts finally elect a woman as chief executive? And will that be Maura Healey? There are several women who are in the race or will get into the race. But there's a couple of cautionary tales out there for Attorney General Healey. One, we've never elected a woman as governor, and there's been several women, Evelyn Murphy, Shannon O'Brien, Martha Coakley, all ran and didn't quite make it. But particularly for attorneys general who've run for governor of Massachusetts, and particularly Democrats, there's kind of a graveyard of candidates, Scott Harshbarger, Tom Riley, and Martha Coakley. So even though it may look like all is clear, sometimes when things look too easy, they might be too easy.
So I want to stay with this for a second, Gary and Lisa. In fact, on the Democratic side, now that former State Senator Ben Downing withdrew from the governor's race, on the Democratic side, two women declared candidates, Sonia Chang Diaz and, why is her name out of my head? Diane, somebody help me.
Danielle Allen.
Thank you. I'm flailing on live radio. Danielle Allen. I don't know why Professor Allen's name just wouldn't come to my head. And, you know, speculation about Maura Healey. I wonder, would it be really groundbreaking if only women were running on one side of this ticket, Lisa?
Yeah, I think it would be. And it's actually something that, you know, kind of funnily enough, Eric Lesser, when he announced for LG this morning, kind of, you know, hinted at, you know, he's ready to support the next governor, whoever she may be. That wasn't his exact wording. But yeah, I mean, you saw this was a big year for women, you know, kind of breaking barriers across Massachusetts. And yes, there is quite the glass ceiling, you know, up and down the ballot for that, you know, as we just discussed. But I mean, Boston having essentially two female mayors this year, and North Adams having its first female mayor. And you're just seeing stuff like that across the Commonwealth. So it's really setting the stage for something, you know, maybe even bigger. Maybe this is finally the year.
And Gary Daffin, if it is, what does it signal about the state, or what could it mean policy-wise down the path for the Commonwealth? I mean, so let's get back to people's everyday lives. What changes?
You know, I think that depends on which woman is elected, or which woman is elected. There is a big debate, not a debate, but a discussion or lots of frustration within the Democratic Party about how progressive the party really wants to be. And so, yes, we saw a progressive movement in Boston in a poorly attended election, really. And what looks like a sort of a realignment politically in Boston. But the question is whether that is really where the state is in general, and whether the large group of unenrolled voters will be more centrist than some of the progressives would like the state to move towards. So I think it's really a question as to where the debate within the Democratic Party moves, particularly as we have all of the chaos in Washington and the lack of movement, and people are just really frustrated about that. So I think it depends on whether we have someone who's more progressive and pushes that agenda, or someone who's going to be a little bit more moderate. I think that will also influence who, in fact, gets into the race.
So let's stay there for a second. And I do want to put this question out to listeners out there. Do you think this is a year where you will see struggle for the soul of the political parties in Massachusetts? Is there the same kind of fight going on the Republican and Democratic side as at the national level, or are we unique or distinct in your mind in some way? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To answer that question or join this conversation, and what do you think about that, Lisa Kaczynski?
All right. Well, let's start with, I don't know, the Republicans. Definitely this is a year where at least it was shaping up to be a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. Let's start with that. I mean, we were potentially headed for, you know, a conservative Trump-backed Jeff Deal primary against a moderate Republican governor. Now that, you know, Baker's not running, you still have the conservative Trump-backed candidate, you know, kind of standing alone on the Republican side right now. And a lot of more moderate Baker-aligned people in the Republican Party still searching for another candidate to kind of step up and be their standard bearer. So that's kind of an ongoing thing with the Republicans. And on the Democratic side, the three candidates who are, the two candidates who are in the race right now, and then, you know, Ben Downing, who recently exited, and Maura Healey, are all various shades of progressive. But, you know, that's not always necessarily where the state is. Yes, this is a blue state, but Democratic primaries, you know, were one thing, and the general election is another. And remember, this is a state that keeps electing kind of these more moderate Republican governors. 57%, I think, right now, of voters are independent, or unenrolled, I guess I should say. So it's very interesting. There seems to be a lot of appetite for progressive politics, more progressive politics among the Democratic electorate based on the past few cycles that we've seen here. But this will be a big test of that, you know, again, especially without a really big name Republican candidate in the race right now.
And Gary Daffin, whoever does win for governor, who enters and wins, will have to win across the entire state. And it is a diverse state. We tend to think of Massachusetts as very Democratic, and certainly our state legislature is. But, you know, more than a million voters voted for Donald Trump in 2016. There are a lot of regional variations. We are economically diverse, racially and ethnically diverse. So is a statewide election a place to play out the struggle for the soul of a party, or is that just impractical in 2022?
Well, I don't think that the statewide races in Massachusetts are necessarily solely about the soul of the Democratic Party. I think this year the Republicans looks like they're pretty much going to self-destruct and not really gain much traction with the voters overall. So there is going to be a debate largely among this group that we're talking about, the unenrolled voters. They have a say in the direction of the state's policy and the state's Democratic politics, basically, because it's not just the primary that determines who wins. And so there is going to be a struggle within the party, just like we had in the presidential election, about how progressive is too progressive, if you will. And remember, Joe Biden won Massachusetts, even though we had the very progressive Senator Warren running for president at the time as well. Now, it was late in the game, and people, I think, thought that he was going likely to win, but he won significantly. And I think that may give us a sense of, you know, where the overall state might fall.
And Gary, what do you think are the issues that are going to drive people to the polls in 2022 here in the Commonwealth?
Well, obviously, we may still have COVID. How we have handled COVID over the next 6 to 10 months will determine where some people vote. I think the economy is going to be a big thing. We have this great, you know, we have inflation. We have this great resignation, as we say. I think that's going to really have an influence on how people think about their futures. And so there may be issues that we aren't necessarily attuned to now. So the post-COVID issues, I think, as people think about their futures, and the economy, as always, will be a primary issue.
So Lisa Kaczynski, sounds like you wanted to say something else. Go ahead and jump in.
I will add to that. Definitely COVID, economic recovery, education issues along with that, you know, are definitely something that we'll see. And climate, that's going to be a huge thing on the Democratic side. It has been in the past couple of cycles, increasingly so. And you're going to see a lot of attention on that. Really, I mean, as we showed that even in Boston and municipal level all the way on up from the state house, you know, up through the governor's race. And with that, transportation, a lot of these statewide candidates are going to, especially out in Western Massachusetts, are really fighting, you know, especially with these hardest hit communities with COVID. This is the opportunity. People are really taking to push longstanding inequities and try and rectify them.
So I want to stay with you for a second, Lisa. You made a reference earlier to Democratic State Senator Eric Lesser announcing that he is jumping into the lieutenant governor's race. A couple things I want to pick up on there, because that seems kind of interesting this year. The LG's race, you know, the Boston Globe just recently reporting this, has not been a big sought-after role. But there are a lot of interesting players at least kicking the idea around. What do you make of that?
Yeah, you know, kind of as I think that was Matt Stout in the Globe, you know, kind of as he was able to report there, this is a good way to raise your profile. And it's, you know, in a race where it's looking like things are going to favor the Democrats, maybe you don't quite have the profile yet to run for governor. Lieutenant governor is a great platform. And sure, it's a little bit of a, you know, there's not a lot of responsibility. It's a little bit of, at least constitutionally, it's kind of a make of it what you will sort of job beyond the governor's council. But, you know, people really do look to the lieutenant governors. I mean, Karen Polito is pretty beloved in some municipalities across, you know, across the Commonwealth. And this is a way to build up name recognition. If, you know, maybe you're getting stalled out at the, you know, in the Senate or the House, you want to take your politics and take your game to the next level and to try and help your constituents. This is a great platform to do that, raise your name recognition, maybe set yourself up for a governor run down the line, maybe set yourself up for something else on the national stage. This is a pretty, it's a little bit of a lower stakes way to, you know, get yourself out there.
And Gary, I think some people might assume that lieutenant governor just runs on a ticket with the governor, but that's not the case in Massachusetts.
70%.
So I think I may have lost Gary Daffin there, so we'll come back to him. Lisa, that's not the case in Massachusetts. They're separate races here.
They are separate races. They tend to eventually, you know, kind of come together and run as a ticket, like, you know, the Baker Polito, you know, became the ticket and everything like that. But yeah, no, they are separate races. They're going to have, you know, their own debates, their own issues, their own fields. You know, it's not like you're seeing, let's say, Maura Healey and Eric Lesser running as a team right now, or, you know, Sonia Chang Diaz and Kim Driscoll or something like that, who Kim is, you know, talking about potential in the current candidates right now. But yeah, so these are very different, but they are going to have to work together. It's going to be really interesting to watch, you know, the debates both within these individual races and, you know, kind of how things might connect depending on who emerges, you know, in the governor's and lieutenant governor's primaries.
So I think we're getting Gary back. Before I go back to him for one last question, let me just ask you, Lisa, to give us a rundown of the ballot questions that are coming. And I want to remind listeners, again, doesn't feel important now, but we almost all just got startled by an egg shortage, right? That almost happened here at the turn of the year because of a ballot question people voted on back in 2016 and forgot about. So what are the three questions that we can expect to see in November?
Yeah, that was a scramble. So right now, the biggest one, the one that has gotten the most attention so far, I'll start there, is the question about how to classify app-based drivers. That's your Uber, Lyft, I think like DoorDash and Instacart drivers. That's going to be by far the biggest fight that we're going to see. And again, there are four questions that have advanced kind of through the process so far out of it keeps getting cold with each cut. They now still have to go through the legislature, and there are a few other steps before they actually make the ballot. But there are two versions right now of this gig economy question, and it's basically classifying these drivers in terms of what benefits they will receive. That's basically what it affects. But this is going to be, you know, it sounds wonky and policy driven, but it's going to be a really expensive fight that can actually be one of those things that motivates people to the polls, because this a similar measure in California backed by Uber and Lyft was the most expensive ballot campaign in California's history, I think. So this is going to be a really big motivating fight this fall, should it make it to the ballot and, you know, through the remaining processes.
All right. Thanks for that. So Gary Daffin, I know we have you back. Last word to you. What is the thing you're watching for this year? Maybe a little off the beaten path that people, it may not be on their radar screens.
You know, I can't think of anything that's way off the beaten path, but I believe that what I'm looking at is to see how the sort of embracing of progressive agenda is going to stick. I have this sinking feeling or a hunch that once we move down the road, particularly in Boston, of going after some of the more progressive agenda policy items, that we may have a bit of a backlash in Boston. And certainly if we try to move some of those issues across the state, I'm looking at, you know, how is the state overall going to embrace those and look at those and how that will impact how these races will end up in November.
All right. That is Gary Daffin, Executive Director of the Multicultural AIDS Coalition, as well as the co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And Lisa Kaczynski, a political reporter and author of the Massachusetts Playbook. Thanks to you, too, Lisa. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
We have been doing Ask the Doctors for nearly 22 months here on Radio Boston Now, folks, and wow, it feels as important today as it did in those early days in 2020. So let's jump right in. It's time. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. What do you need to know right now about rapid at-home testing? Should you be masking? What kind of masks? When and where? What about immunity? Do you have it from Omicron? If you get Omicron, will you have it? Ask your questions. Joining us now, Dr. Cassandra Pierre, infectious disease physician and the associate hospital epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center, also an assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. Welcome back, Dr. Pierre.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Tiziana.
Great to have you. Also, we have a new voice this week on Ask the Doctors, Dr. Simone Wilds, an infectious disease expert at South Shore Health. Dr. Wilds, welcome for the first time.
Thank you for having me.
And hearing my scratchy voice here, doctors, is a great point to say I feel particularly invested in Ask the Doctors this week. I always do, but I am broadcasting from home this week after getting a breakthrough case of coronavirus a week and a half ago, vaccinated and boosted. And I know we're seeing more of those and so many people concerned about Omicron. So let's start there. Dr. Pierre, the latest numbers show a dramatic rise in infection. The state logged a 20.6 to 20.7% positive test rate, and that's almost double the test rate of last Monday. How are you reacting to that, and is it about to get worse, or does that mean we are at some peak?
So first of all, Tiziana, I am sorry that you are sick, that you've gotten a breakthrough case, but I'm glad that you are well enough to broadcast.
Thank you.
These numbers are certainly, if you had asked us a few weeks ago, a few months ago, were higher than we would have expected. But in the setting of a very highly transmissible virus, or a virus that at least experiences highly transmissible, and the winter holidays, we kind of had a perfect storm that allowed people to go home, to travel, and to then transmit the virus. So it absolutely is concerning. However, a few factors may be on our side. One, that the holidays are over, at least for now. And so people are resuming the rhythms of their lives. There's less traveling, less large groups of people coming together. And also, more people, we see here at Boston Medical Center, are getting vaccinated, whether that be for their primary series, which is wonderful, or for their boosters. So that's really important. That said, you know, we still have a road ahead of us. This is, you know, a virus that is experienced at least as causing more transmission due to potentially immune evasion. And so it's something that we are going to be keeping our eye out. And we do expect to see more cases, but hopefully keep the numbers of death and severe disease lower than they are now.
There's a lot there to pick up on, Dr. Pierre, but Dr. Wildes, I think the piece I'll turn to you on first is what Dr. Pierre just said about immunity and evasion. We are increasingly hearing questions from people about, you know, former infection held at least some potential to keep you immune from future infection. That does not appear to be the case with Omicron. So one, is that correct? And two, if that is correct, could we see, and given the level of transmissibility of Omicron, could we see a huge surge in Omicron that would last a very long time? Because basically anyone could get it.
Yes. I first want to hope that you feel better soon. And to what Dr. Pear had said, you know, we are seeing a lot more cases. In fact, so many breakthrough cases here at our hospital, too, at South Shore Health. And the big question is about the immune evasion. And we all were hoping that with Omicron that there would be better protection with the vaccines. And unfortunately, that's not the case. However, we do see that there's a significant increase when in our immunity when we get the booster. And so, you know, the key thing that I've been trying to encourage everyone who have gotten their primary series of vaccines to get the booster. You know, right now there's 33% of individuals who have gotten the booster. So that's definitely not where we want people to be. We definitely want to have higher numbers because we have found that Omicron is very good at the immune evasion process. And so we want to encourage people to get their booster. Now, the other question was about levels of transmission, whether or not we expect to see higher levels. And I think right now we will more than likely be seeing higher numbers, but hopefully they're going to peak soon. I think the data suggests that maybe in a week or two, the number should peak, which would coincide with after all the holiday travel that we should start to see numbers decreasing, which will be very good for us, especially as the hospitals are like bursting at their seams right now.
All right. Calls are just flowing in. So let's start 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus questions. Judy is on the line in Brookline. Please go ahead, Judy.
Hi. I understand about the increased transmissibility, but it would be really helpful for me to know how people that are getting breakthrough infections are getting them. Like, what did they do? Did they get together with family and outsiders? We're very careful, and I have an immunocompromised spouse I'm trying to protect, and wear, you know, a mask when I go to the supermarket. But I don't wear a mask outside anymore if I can keep my distance. And I want to know, what are people doing that they got it, even though they were triple vaxxed?
Great question, Dr. Pierre. What can we tell? What can we say?
I think there's a variety of ways, but I think, you know, obviously this is a person-to-person infection, so the settings in which we have seen COVID-19 being spread are still the scenarios in which they continue to spread, including for breakthrough infections. And that includes holiday celebrations. That includes potentially going to a gym where people are not consistently masked, enjoying dinner, a meal with individuals around a table that are not masked. Individuals that come into your home, potentially caregivers, might bring that in. These are the situations where we have seen and continue to see it spread. To your point, Judy, I would say going out and exercising in the elements is something that I feel people can continue to do safely. We know that the risk of transmission continues to be low, even for Omicron in those outdoor spaces with good ventilation, as long as we keep good distance from others. So I think that was something that I would continue to recommend, you know, that you do if this is part of your, you know, self-care regimen. But you know, going to the grocery store, those brief limits of time, you know, those brief times where we are in contact with other people, potentially lower risk of transmission, but, you know, to the point where people may be out and about without masks, there is some smaller risk. The larger risks are when you are with others, especially in large crowds, in, you know, celebrating without masks or in indoor spaces without masks. Those are the continue to be the risks that we see.
All right, let's pick up a question from Twitter, actually. This one comes from @LoganLife, Laura Logan, who says, is it beneficial to use a nasal irrigator such as a neti pot, or would that be more likely to spread the virus if you are carrying it? Dr. Wiles.
Well, you know, with regards to the neti pot, I don't think we have a lot of data as to how it's going to affect transmission. However, I would say that I would imagine that if you do have COVID and you're using the neti pot, you're in a place where there are a lot of other people, that it could be potentially a source of spreading it because it's a respiratory virus. And so I probably wouldn't recommend the neti pot use at this time. I think we're going to try to minimize the spread of COVID as much as we can within our families and in our communities. And anything we do at home that can help to minimize that spread, I think I would encourage people to stay away from doing things that increase the spread in the community.
Thank you for that. 800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus question, or as Laura just did, you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We have Risa on the line in Newburyport. Go ahead, Risa.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I was wondering how much the caretakers of my six-month-old son, who are all triple vaccinated, should avoid contact with unvaccinated people.
So, and Dr. Pierre, let's come back to you. So the question is, if one is vaccinated but taking care of someone who is particularly vulnerable, Risa has a six-month-old, but I think this is a broader question as well, what are the risks of being exposed to unvaccinated people? You know, I understand not everybody can control that, but your reactions there.
Right, Risa. Yeah, no, I think it's a great question. I have under 5-year-old children as well, so worry about their risks and their health. You know, I think it's difficult to dictate who other people might socialize with, but in terms of what the risks are for individuals who are fully vaccinated, we know that there continues to be a lower risk of transmission to those individuals compared to individuals who have been unvaccinated. That said, unvaccinated individuals continue to pose a risk for both infection and transmission of infection. And breakthrough cases, unfortunately, in your case as well, Tiziana, as you have personal experience of, can happen. And so the good news, I would say, for Risa, is that we have some growing evidence, including from household studies, that show that even with Omicron, individuals who have received that booster do seem to have a lower risk of going on to cause a secondary infection. And so that's really good news. I would say that as much as possible, though, you know, if we are in large indoor spaces where there are individuals who are of unknown vaccine status to us, having that mask in place will always be a good strategy.
Let's go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm hoping that we've got Bonnie in Mattapan up. Bonnie, do we have you?
Yes, you do.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
Hi. So my question is, how soon after a COVID infection should someone get their primary series of vaccination?
Okay, Dr. Wiles.
So Bonnie, that's a really great question and one that I get quite frequently. And there are actually two answers that I tend to give my patients. And there's one that I will say that, you know, the CDC recommendations online, they say, well, you know, you can wait for 90 days because we know that you have antibodies. They're probably going to hang around for that period of time. So you can wait for 90 days. After your COVID infection before you get the vaccine. What I do say to a lot of patients, though, is that if you are well and say 2 weeks after the acute infection, you're doing well and you're someplace that they're offering the vaccine, you can go ahead and get the vaccine at that time. You know, the CDC didn't give very hard and fast rules about when you absolutely have to get the vaccines. So we try to get as many people vaccinated as we can when we can. And so if you're over your acute illness and you're able to go out and interact with individuals, you can go ahead and get your vaccine. The only absolute thing that I must mention, if you got monoclonal antibodies, you absolutely have to wait for those 90 days before you get your vaccine, because it affects how effective your vaccine is going to be.
So you should check with your, if you received any health care after having COVID, Dr. Wilds, you should check with your healthcare provider to be sure whether or not you got that treatment, monoclonal antibodies, right? Because if you did, you have to wait.
Absolutely. So always check with your healthcare provider before you go ahead and get the vaccine.
Okay, thank you. That's really helpful. Okay, let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. And again, you can tweet us as well. We've got Abhishek in Cambridge. Go ahead.
Hello. So my question was about colleges and universities. So as the spring semester starts, there'll be hundreds and thousands of students who will come back to campuses. And with the high transmission rate, do you think that that's a good idea to bring everyone back in January, which would further overwhelm the Boston area hospitals?
So I get a sense that you have a feeling on this, Abhishek, but let me turn to Dr. Pierre. Dr. Pierre, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks for calling, Abhishek. I think it's a great question, and some universities have handled this in different ways. Some are putting a pause on the return to in-person schooling, and some are just diving right in. I think, honestly, we do have tools at our disposal right now to reduce the risk of transmission. And so it is true that many are returning to the campuses, maybe potentially infected. Many of the universities, though, continue to have really good testing requirements in place to reduce the risk of in-classroom or on-campus transmission. And those testing requirements and guidances are backed up by creating spaces where students can safely quarantine or isolate and continue to receive their education. So I think this really is a question about how individual universities handle this on a case-by-case basis. Obviously, having a high risk, or a population that's likely to be out and about, potentially at higher risk for exposure and then infection coming back, is recipe for continuing to have high levels of transmission. But if there are good policies in place to ensure that people are tested, that they are isolated promptly after diagnosis and detection, then I think that you can really limit that. And there is a really huge benefit on the other side of having that in person, or at least returning on campus for education, in terms of lowering the consequences that we've seen, the mental health consequences of isolation. So I think it's a tough question, but I think the individual processes you put in place can help to mitigate transmission.
You know, Dr. Pierre, you just spoke about testing a couple times there. We've got a caller in Andover, Aztab, who has a question about testing. Aztab, go ahead. Hello, Aztab. Go ahead.
Yes, hi. My question is regarding testing. On New Year's Eve, we were exposed to a person who was tested positive, and my wife has subsequently had some COVID symptoms.
Some symptoms.
And since yesterday, I've been trying to go to a testing center, both of us, and there are none available. CVS, Walgreens have no appointments available till 11th of January. I tried to get home testing kits at CVS and Walgreens. I've been to like 8 of them since yesterday in our area of 3 different towns. None of them have any testing kits, home testing kits available, in stock. The government and the state websites, when I ordered the testing kits, they said will be delivered between January 10th and January 17th. I don't understand what's going on and how are we supposed to deal with this situation.
Estab, I'm so sorry for your situation and your frustration. And Dr. Wildes, I know you know the story we just heard is not uncommon right now.
Absolutely. I can't tell you how many people have been complaining of the same thing, just the difficulty finding the test. And I know that when we started with COVID about 2 years ago, we had challenges with testing, and unfortunately, we still have challenges today. I wish I had a quick answer as to where you can find tests. One thing I would suggest is just keep calling. You know, I know that they're expecting more shipments of testing. I know Governor Baker has been trying to garner more tests, because it's really important so people can do testing not only at home, but at the different facilities. So I would say just keep calling the pharmacy, call your primary care, just keep calling. And of course, if you develop symptoms and get really sick, then you might have to go to urgent care so someone can do a test on you, which most hospitals and facilities have. But I'm not saying you need to go right now, but in case you develop some severe symptoms.
So that is also your advice, Dr. Wildes, is if you are experiencing symptoms and you are not able through any of the standard channels, then you, I'm aware that there has been a plea, for example, from emergency room doctors not to go to an emergency room to try to get a COVID test right now because they are overwhelmed. But if you are symptomatic and you don't have other options, you're saying go to that urgent care facility, for example, and get tested. Is that the priority?
Yes, that is absolutely the priority right now. We don't want you to stay at home and suffer. We want you to come in because we have tests available that we can help, but not to go to the emergency room if you're not severely ill.
All right, let's try to pick up one more call here. I'm going to go to, if we've got her up, let's go to Louise in Cape Cod. Do we have Louise up or Lucy?
Yes, we do.
I'm sorry, which is it? Hi, go ahead.
Hi. My daughter is 16 weeks pregnant. She's had both her vaccines and her booster. And her daughter, her doctor is very concerned about pregnant women and COVID. If she were to get some kind of a breakthrough case, how does that affect her baby if she were to be relatively in good health with, you know, with the virus? I mean, that it wouldn't put her in the emergency room or, any, you know, the intensive care or anything, because she's young and healthy.
Great question, Dr. Pierre.
Hi. So I guess congratulations on your hopefully soon to be grandchild. But we definitely have received these questions as well. Yes, women who are pregnant are at higher risk for severe complications of COVID-19. However, just as other people who have underlying chronic health conditions that put them at higher risk for severe complications, getting vaccinated and then getting a booster reduces their risk of infection and then also reduces their risk of severe disease and hospitalization. So although, yes, it would be best, especially now, to try and, you know, shield and reduce your daughter's risk of infection at this time, absolutely, because pregnant women who, especially those who are unvaccinated, have a higher risk of preterm labor and complications in the second trimester. We see those happening less in vaccinated and especially in women who are pregnant who have had the booster. So I would say that, yes, we want to reduce the risk of exposure of infection, but we're not particularly worried in young, healthy women who don't have underlying chronic medical conditions to compound concerns of any untoward effects or of increased untoward effects with that additional protection of the booster.
All right. And so, Dr. Pierre, I'm going to stay with you for 1 second longer. On infection, offline before the show, we heard a number of questions, people asking, with there being so many breakthrough cases with Omicron, do we know once somebody has had Omicron whether they are resistant to future transmission or not? Do you get immunity from this exposure? Do we know?
So, you know, we feel like we've seen with other infection, with other variants, with SARS-CoV-2, the Delta and other variants before it, that infection absolutely does increase your immune reserves, that it decreases risk of future infection. And so I would imagine that this would continue to be the case, including for Omicron. But what, you know, the unstated concern, of course, is that as we continue to have transmission, and especially as we continue to have relatively unvaccinated parts of the world, where high levels of transmission can continue to occur, that we may see different variants that may also cause immune evasion. And so we don't know what our relative level of immunity to Omicron may offer us in terms of protection against those. That said, even though we don't have evidence at this point, based on our previous evidence, having this Omicron infection, and especially and particularly most importantly, getting vaccinated and getting boosted will and should continue to provide us meaningful protection against severe complications of further infections in the future.
All right. That is Dr. Cassandra Pierre, infectious disease physician and associate hospital epidemiologist at Boston Medical Center, an assistant professor of medicine at the Boston University School of Medicine. We also had with us Dr. Simone Wilds, an infectious disease expert at South Shore Health. Excuse me, Dr. Pierre, thank you.
Thank you. Get better soon.
Thank you. And Dr. Wilds, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Minna is with us now. He has been an advocate of rapid antigen tests throughout the pandemic, pushing hard on fast, frequent, and accessible testing. He's also been a critic of federal sluggishness on ramping up fast testing. He recently left Harvard University, where he was on faculty at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health and Brigham and Women's Hospital, to join a private company that helps people take rapid tests. Dr. Minna, now chief science officer at biotech software company eMed, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So before the break, Dr. Minna, we were doing Ask the Doctors, and one of the questions we didn't get to was from Patricia in Andover, who's a school nurse, says rapid tests are rough. Positive on a PCR and negative on a rapid test seems so off. Why are they so iffy? And I will say, within my own family, you know, I have a breakthrough case, a number of family members who tested negative on a home test and then positive on a PCR within a day. All anecdotal, I recognize. So compare that to what we actually know with the evidence, Dr. Minna.
Yeah, this is one of the most confusing aspects of these tests for so many people, because we started the pandemic with assuming that PCR is the gold standard. And that's because PCR is the gold standard for clinical medicine. But if the way that we are using these tests today is not to ask the question, should I be at the doctor? Should I be in the hospital? Most people are using the test today to ask, should I isolate? Should my child isolate? Am I infectious? And for that question, we don't need the exquisite sensitivity of a PCR, because PCR is so sensitive that it will stay positive for weeks and sometimes even months after somebody's infectious. What we need is a tool that allows us to know if I have a lot of virus in me right now so that I'm a risk to others. And that's where the rapid antigen tests really excel. And it actually is intentional that a rapid antigen test should not always be positive when a PCR is positive, because PCR is not specific to telling people whether or not they need to isolate. It can be positive regardless of whether you're infectious, whereas a rapid antigen test is only going to be positive when you do, in fact, need to isolate and you are infectious.
So if you are sniffly, runny nose, and a cough, and you test negative on an at-home rapid antigen test, that means you are not infectious and you do not need to isolate?
So I would say that symptoms are not a perfect correlate by any means with infectiousness, but with Omicron in particular, and with a shifting distribution of symptoms. Symptoms are now coming on earlier, but that's not because the virus has definitely changed. And it's actually more a reflection of the fact that many of us now have pre-existing immunity from vaccines or previous infections. And so our immune symptoms are actually what we're oftentimes feeling early. And so we could then become infectious the day after our symptoms start, for example, because the immune system is ramping up really fast and it causes congestion, sniffly nose. And that's why the symptoms have changed markedly from before in the pandemic, when it was loss of smell, cough, and no congestion. So now we have immune-mediated symptoms causing us to recognize that, hey, we might be infected even before we necessarily become fully infectious. So my recommendation is if you start to become symptomatic right now, assume you're infected, assume you're infectious, and use a test, maybe even not that first day, but use a test the next day when the virus has had a little bit more chance to grow up and be able to be detected on these home tests.
So I am struck by the fact that you've sort of become an interested party in this. You left the public health sphere to go into the private sector on this. And I guess I'm assuming both that you were driven by frustration you've expressed at our slowness to adopt rapid testing. But I also wonder, do you feel that in any way it clouds your view of the efficacy and importance of those rapid tests? I'm sure you're used to addressing that question head on.
Yeah, I don't really think at the moment it's clouding my view, because I would say it's still following the science very much. And I would argue that my message hasn't really changed for frankly 2 years at this point. I'm not too concerned by that. In fact, much of what I've been calling for still is that we need free and frequent and accessible rapid tests to the population. Now, I work now for a company that would not benefit from free and accessible rapid tests getting out to everyone. We authenticate tests that are specific for purposes. And so the public health use that I'm still calling for would not necessarily, in my view, really be in conflict necessarily. But to your point, I mean, I think it's extremely important for everyone to recognize that there are potential biases the moment their incentives. But just to be clear, there's plenty of biases in academia for people to be dedicated to their research, I guess I'll put it that way, just as much.
All right. We are actually a little short on time today. We appreciate your answers, especially clearing up what I think is the main question people have right now, which is when and how to most effectively use rapid at-home tests. That's Dr. Michael Minna, Chief Science Officer at biotech software company eMed, and formerly of Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thank you so much for giving us some of your time today.
Great. Absolutely.
So finally today, folks, we bid farewell to show producer and director Jamie Bologna, who has been with Radio Boston longer than anyone else on the show. His unwavering presence behind the glass and his delightful voice behind the microphone on segments and when he has guest hosted have been a constant and passionate presence. Jamie moves on now, leaving the station for a new opportunity. We will miss you, Jamie, and we wish the best of luck to you. Take good care. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.